This is the Education Gadfly Show.
David wearing a tie today. Yeah. What's happening?
I don't know. I decided to dress myself.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at FordhamInstitute.org. And now, please join me in welcoming our distinguished special guest for this week, Donald Nielsen. Don, welcome to the show.
Thank you, sir. Nice to be with you.
Yeah, Don is the program director of the Discovery Institute's American Center for Transforming Education and the author of Every School, One Citizen's Guide to Transforming Education. Great to have you with us. Also joining us, my co-host, David Griffith.
Hey, Mike.
David, wearing a tie today. Yeah. What's happening?
I don't know. I decided to dress myself today.
Oh, my goodness. We're having an event later. That's exciting. That's exciting. But we are, and that's going to be on career technical education.
That's right.
But we are going to talk a little bit about your book, Don, which you've recently re-released in an updated form. And let's talk about it on the Ed Reform Update. Don, first of all, my understanding is that you come from a business background and that you've been making
right.
the case for several years that, you know, that school districts and especially school boards are not going to solve the problems that plague our schools. What really needs to happen is for states to find ways to empower school leaders with a lot more autonomy, as you would see in the business world where leaders have lots more autonomy. Did I basically get that right? You want to expound upon that?
Well, yes. No, I initially thought the entity of change was an urban system, and so I ran for a school board. You know, as you guys well know, someone like me is not qualified to be a teacher. I'm not qualified to be a principal. No one's going to hire me as a superintendent. So the only way to get inside the system was to run for the school board, which I did, served 8 years. And my goal was to transform an urban system.
Yeah.
I figured that was the entity of change, and if we could transform the Seattle public schools, we would create a template for the nation. And we did. We actually did transform the Seattle public schools to the point where people were actually moving back into the city to attend the public schools. It mm-hmm. was remarkable. Now, I don't know if you guys remember mm-hmm. this, but we had hired a retired major general mm-hmm. to be our superintendent.
Yeah.
And he was unbelievable.
Yeah. He's a beloved leader, I remember.
Most yeah. authentic leader yeah. I've ever met in my life. And without him, we would not have been able to do anything. But he was terrific. But the point I wanted to raise was I got off the school board after 8 years in 2001, and two of my other colleagues on the board got off at the same time. And then 2 years later, the other four, there were seven on our board, and the other four got off. So by the end of 2003, we had a totally new school board. By 2006, we'd gone through two superintendents. We had a financial crisis in the district, and virtually everything that we had put in place had been reversed or terminated or canceled or whatever you want to call it. And it became became immediately obvious that you can change an urban district, but it's not sustainable. And so I've concluded that the only way to make a long-term difference, a sustainable difference in our schools, is at the state level.
Mm-hmm. Now, when I read about this idea, Don, it strikes me that what you are talking about sounds a little bit like charter schools. We are, of course, celebrating National Charter Schools Week. I know charter schools are still brand new in Washington, and so they haven't been an option for reformers in Seattle for very long, and they're still ramping up. But tell me what you think about that. I mean, I have seen a lot of proposals to try to give traditional public schools the kind of authority that charter schools enjoy. And in most places, it just hasn't happened, or, you know, there's been some baby steps in that direction, and that has not proven to be sustainable. What do you think? I mean, is charters, you know, chartering schools, is that what you really want?
Well, I once wrote an editorial against charter schools, and the rationale I had then, and I still have, is that charter schools are simply deregulated public schools. And if it's such a good idea to deregulate some schools, why is it not an even better idea to deregulate all schools?
Yep.
And I still feel that way. But we've been unable to do that. So in lieu of doing that, I'm highly supportive of charter schools. I wish we had a lot more of them.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is the question. And David, I don't know about your thoughts on this. I mean, there, you know, certainly people talk about portfolio school districts, and we've seen efforts in Seattle, but also in places like Denver, It's probably the most famous spot, you know, where you say, okay, we're going to have charter schools, but we're also going to have district schools that are deregulated, in your words, Don. You know, and sometimes that seems to be working, but it just has been a challenge to keep those schools with the autonomy that they were once promised, that a new group comes in and they say, hey, why, you know, I want to get control over these schools. And, you know, there's some controversy or there's some question about how they're spending the money or they're doing things differently. And some new superintendent comes in and decides that he or she doesn't like that so much. I mean, that you really need something. The thing with charters is that it's a different legal entity and there are contracts and they're the force of law. You know, it's not so easy to undo it.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be interested to hear Don's thoughts on this, right? At some point, you're going to have a political battle no matter what you do, right? Because at some point, there's going to be a governing authority, right? And that governing authority is going to be responsive to politics at some level.
Yeah.
And so I don't know that there's any sort of fully bulletproof, politically insulated mechanism that we could come up with. And if we did, I'm not 100% sure that I would support that, right? Yeah. I mean, it's we part of our point that we're constantly making is that charter schools are, frankly, responsive to the public, right? They're publicly regulated. They're publicly funded. They're public schools. We've simply given them a little more autonomy. So I'd be interested just in your thoughts, Don, because my assumption is your argument is something along the lines of, you know, districts are basically in a stranglehold, right? Due to union politics, sort of the way that the system works, and that a state level sort of initiative is more likely to be sustainable because its governors have more scope for action. It's more responsive to sort of a broader electorate. Is that basically where you're coming from? Or
well, I guess I've concluded that the way to fix our schools is to address the system itself, not individual issues related to schools, and we've been reforming schools for 40 years, and test scores don't change. So I've concluded that the system is the problem, and the only way you can change the system is with state law. Mm-hmm. The states control who's allowed to teach, who's allowed to lead, who's allowed to govern. They control the curriculum, they control graduation requirements, they control testing. I mean, they control, and they control most of the money, which is the most important thing. And so if you want to fix your schools or change your schools or change the system, it has to be done at the state, and it's got to be done with legislation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, look, you won't get an argument from us on the importance of state policy, though, I do think that part of the story of reform has been that we have made a lot of changes to state policies, and many times they don't seem to result in real change at the school level or the classroom level. You know, we kind of have big fights among ourselves in the policy world, and it seems irrelevant to the world of practice. Now, you know, you can point to some outliers. You say, okay, Florida, you know, has had this incredible record of achievement and progress for its kids, and that seems to be related to the state policy agenda it's put in. You can make the same case for Massachusetts at various points, you know, for Indiana, maybe New Jersey, go back long enough to Texas and North Carolina. I mean, it does seem like these policies make some difference, but they make a difference because they lead to some kind of important change in classrooms. And too often, you know, we have these big debates, we get a law passed in the state legislature, we expect it to lead to certain changes, and you just hear crickets. So there's that.
Wow. Yeah. That's the sound of crickets right there. Yeah.
I will say one thing, Don. It is, I've been digging in on this question of about whether our schools have been getting better. And I will say, look, you know, test scores, depending on what you look at, but still, you know, they have gone up. I mean, I've been digging in for an article looking at elementary schools right now. And I know that the story for younger kids is better than the story for older kids, but, you know, huge gains in both math and reading if you break it down by the different major racial subgroups. Now, tons of that happened in the sort of late 90s, early 2000s, which may have been largely because of, you know, the booming 90s, economy getting better, the child poverty rate plummeting, good things happening like that that may have resulted in a lot of those scores. It's still a little hard to tell whether it was the schools getting better that deserves all the credit for that. But look, kids today are reading and doing math 2 to 3 grade levels ahead of where they were back then, especially our poorest kids, kids of color, low performing kids. So I just think it's important that we, I am nervous about the idea that we've done all this reform for 40 years and none of it's worked or none of it's made a difference. My sense is, you know, the typical urban school today is better than it was back then. not to say we don't have a long, long way to go until we get to the point where every kid gets a great education.
Well, you can find places that are better than they used to be, for sure. But the fact of the matter is, as a nation, we effectively educate about 30% of our children.
Yeah.
And in fact, to this day, we, as a country, we turn out some of the smartest people in the world. So there's about 30% of our kids that are doing just fine. But 70% are not. And 70% of the kids will not graduate or, well, of the 70 out of 100 kids, 20 to 25 are going to drop out before they graduate.
Yep.
And the other 40 to 45 are going to graduate with a diploma that won't get them into even a community college, let alone anything else. Some of them can't even qualify for the military. So, you know, when you have an institution that, in my mind, is the most important institution in our society, mm-hmm. and it's failing to perform adequately with 70% of its constituency, that's a crisis.
Yeah. No doubt.
And it's been a crisis for decades.
Yep.
And to me, it's time to deal with it.
Yep.
Don, do you have any advice for reformers? I mean, I think there's a broad sense that we're on the defensive right now in many places. I frankly agree with you that the state action is sort of the only plausible route to sustainable reform, but it seems that even there,
mm-hmm.
we've hit a wall right now.
At least in the bluest states, yeah, like Washington.
Yeah. Right. Can you solve that problem for us, please?
Well, I don't know that I can solve it, but I have. That's why I redid the book. The last chapter of the book, which is a new chapter, is a game plan for a state. And I had the privilege of going back to Madison, Wisconsin. The chair of the Education Committee of the House in Wisconsin had read my original book,
mm-hmm.
and asked me to come back and speak to his committee, mm-hmm. and the staff. And I said I would, and I went back to Madison, mm-hmm. and he had put in place the staff of the Senate committee as well. So we had the Senate committee, the House committee, mm-hmm. and the staff of both committees in the room. It was a fairly good-sized group. And I gave a presentation on the contents of my original book. And the guy's name was Jeremy Theisfeld. He was the chair of the Education Committee. And we were walking back to his office, and he said to me, he said, Don, he said, I don't disagree with anything you've said. You're right on. But he said, I still don't know where to start.
Yeah.
He said, if you were in my shoes, what would you do, and in what order would you do it? And I said to him, what a great question. He said, I have not addressed that question, but I will. And I spent the next 6 months trying to figure out what you need to do as a state in order to transform your schools. And that's chapter 14 of my book. And I sent it back to him in October of 2017, and he liked it. He said, this is exactly what I needed. But then he said, I can't deal with it this year because we can't even pass a budget here in Wisconsin. And until we pass a budget, we're not going to deal with other issues. And they finally did pass a budget, but then they ran out of time. And then, of course, Scott Walker got defeated. And so Wisconsin is now out of play as far as I'm concerned. The states I'm working on are Idaho, Mississippi, Texas, and Florida. Those are the four states I think have a shot at doing something productive with their schools.
All right. Excellent. Well, thanks again for joining us. Again, Donald Nielsen, Program Director of the Discovery Institute's American Center for Transforming Education. Check out his book, Every School, One Citizen's Guide to Transforming Education, especially Chapter 14, where we're going to figure out what the state policy agenda should be. I'm looking forward to checking that out myself. Thanks so much for joining us, Don. Hope you'll come back sometime.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Yeah, I hope you're enjoying this spring weather. Finally has happened here. Yeah,
man, we had a cold one yesterday, but we're back in the groove today.
You've been promising this weather, Amber, to us for months now. Finally has delivered.
I know. Better late than ever.
Yeah, and now my kids' outdoor swim season starts next week, so summer's almost here. That's good.
Cool.
All right, so what you got for us this week?
What do I have? I've got a new NPR working paper from Sarah Cahotes and colleagues that examines whether proven charter school models can successfully replicate or scale up and maintain their effectiveness? So kind of a cool question. They examine a policy reform in Massachusetts in 2010 that raised the cap. This is when they were raising caps on the fraction of funding dedicated to charter school tuition payments in low performing districts. So in other words, the charter operators that the state deemed as proven providers were allowed to expand their existing campuses or open new schools in these low performing districts. All right.
Good.
So as a result, the number of charter schools in Boston doubled from 16 to 32 between 2010 and 2014. And most of those new campuses were linked to these no excuses charter school models.
Mm-hmm.
And in essence, it led to a dramatic growth in the fraction of sixth graders who attended charters. And they increased from about 15 to 31% between those 2010 and 2015 years.
Wow. That's a lot of
analysts
growth.
Go back. Yeah, it's a pretty big jump. Analysts go back and look at these randomized charter school admission lotteries to study the changes in the effectiveness of Boston's charter middle school sector during these years of rapid expansion. And they compare outcomes of students who received the lottery offers to those who didn't, which in essence removes a selection bias that we're always worried about. Now for the findings. They first find that policymakers did, in fact, select the more effective schools for expansion. Those proven providers had produced larger effects than other charter schools before the reform happened. But the key finding is that the Boston charter sector remained effective while doubling in size in the post-reform period, which is a big deal. Proven providers maintained their effectiveness after the reform, while expansion charters generated achievement gains comparable to their parent schools. Specifically, they find that a year of attendance at an expansion school increased math scores by 0.32 standard deviation and ELA test scores by 0.23 standard deviation. And these impacts are comparable to estimates for the parent campuses as well. And so in short, it demonstrated in the eyes of the analysts that the Boston middle school charter sector had increased its effectiveness despite this pretty big growth. And then they dug in a little bit and said, you know, they actually looked at the kids that the expansion charters were serving, and they found that those students were more representative of the general Boston school population of kids than students at other charter schools. So they were doing it with, you know, equally or more disadvantaged children. And then they dig into, okay, why might this have happened? Maybe it was the quality of the fallback schools for the kids who lost the lottery. Maybe that explains the success of these expansion campuses. But they found that those fallback schools were of average quality. So they didn't really, come up as an important source of the variation, the effects they were seeing. And then they started digging into the teachers, and this is my final point. And they found that the teachers at the charter schools delivered pretty effective education, despite the fact that many of them were novices. And there was a substantial amount of teacher turnover. They look at the variation of the teacher in the classroom level, and they find less variation in effectiveness in the charter sector. And then they use some qualitative data, and they just kind of end up saying, you know, this may be due to the charter's centralized management systems that they have in place and more standardized instructional practices. And they gave the example of the principals, all the principals at the expansion campuses were actually former teachers from the parent campus. And leaders in their interviews and whatnot stressed that this was key because these leaders were already familiar with the core practices of the schools. And so I think at the end, they say, you know what, maybe allowing replications of these existing high quality operators is a better way to go than allowing new providers. So I don't know, we can talk about that. But all in all, it was good news for these high performing charters who seek to replicate.
Wow. Well, it's great. And by the way, happy National Charter Schools Week. And by the way,
really?
By the way,
forgot about that.
Wish we had these findings back when there was a big debate in Massachusetts about whether to expand charter school.
Yeah, right.
Was the study just recently published? I mean, was it available in some? You probably don't know the answer to this. It might have been available in some.
Well, I mean, yeah. It takes a while. No, I mean, I don't really mean to be dinging the study for that. I mean, it's just a shame that here we have again evidence that Boston has one of the highest performing charter sectors in the country and can't grow. And it's just it's such a shame. And look, maybe a lesson that there's been this debate in the charter sector that says, well, if we could only demonstrate effective schools, if we built some quality schools, then the opposition would disappear. And that has proven not to be the case, you know? And so the other argument is, hey, grab as much market share as you can, build as many schools as you can, to get the politics right and then, you know, fix the quality later.
I don't know if I can co-sign on that, Mike. I mean, there, I agree with the first part of what you said, which is there's no guarantee that quality will break down political opposition. Yeah. I don't know what to say. I mean,
well, I mean, we have some experiments in this, and there has been this history in the charter sector of improving big sectors after the fact. I mean, Arizona's has gotten a lot better. Texas's has gotten better. We are working on it in Ohio, and we are seeing promising signs there. Look, I'm not saying that's necessarily the best, but we're stuck in Boston. We are stuck.
Yes,
and the theory is there's just too few parents that have the school that they don't have enough political power to keep this thing going.
Yeah.
So there you have it. Now, this question, Amber, that you raise or the study raises about whether we should only replicate these proven models, you know, there's that's a slippery slope also, right? Because that freezes in stone.
Then they can become districts, right?
Yeah. I mean, that this notion that, well, nobody can possibly come up with a better model than what we've seen out there today.
See, I'm less concerned about that. I mean, I just think that in, you know, we've got charter operators that are almost national, right? Many of them. And it just strikes me as, it's not like, I don't know. There's always going to be some new operator coming from somewhere, right? In any given location.
Well, only if we allow that to happen.
I mean, are we really saying that this strikes me as a problem only if every charter authorizer everywhere, right? We're sort of simultaneously agreeing that we're only going to have the top two, you know, 10 or 15 providers, right? And so there was no door, you know, no door where these guys could sneak through. I don't know. I mean, you know, you can disagree with me, Mike.
Look, the data from the National Charter School Authorizer seems to indicate that CMOs do have an advantage, but there has been a real effort in recent years, especially to get single-site schools started by people of color, principals of color, and those are still coming online. The main problem is that there's just fewer people applying for charters than there used to be.
Yeah.
And that's a little bit perplexing. But look,
Boston
should
keep
growing its high-quality charter sector.
Keep growing, try as you can. But, I mean, to you guys' point, I mean, I think in D.C. at least, which is, you know, where we sit, is that there are very few charter operators that are succeeding in Ward 7 and 8.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm from a school that was a mom and pop and couldn't make it. So, you know, on their board. So, I mean, it's definitely, I don't know. I'm of mixed opinions too about this. I'm like, wow, why can't more operators seem to figure out how to do this? You know, when we do have some proof points of one that can do it, but gosh, we need more of them.
Well, and it's also interesting. I mean, it's this question around autonomy. We know that autonomy matters. But at what level? You know, and the truth is, these are not schools that give teachers a lot of autonomy.
Right.
And maybe don't even give principals a lot of autonomy, at least around certain things. They do a lot of stuff centrally.
Yeah.
But they do it a lot better than your traditional district does. I mean, they are rebuilding a system, which is what you've got to do if you're going to run a whole bunch of schools. But somehow they seem to be doing it in a way that is more nimble, that, you know, they're more of a learning community. They keep getting better. I mean, they're being smart about how they roll out a curriculum or how they train teachers or how they ensure quality across classrooms. They seem to have the execution part down better. I can't think of a reason why the districts necessarily can't do that, although the union constraints are a real issue. But whether it's just something about these organizations, the DNA, that they started fresh, that they don't have the legacy, I don't know. It seems to be happening much more so in the charter sector than the district sector.
I think for me, the key question is autonomy over what, right? Yeah. I mean, when it's something like who you're working with on a day-to-day basis, right? I think principals should have, you know, autonomy over hiring, right?
Yeah.
And promotions and compensation and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But there are also these other sort of issues where, I mean, there's no reason that first-year teachers shouldn't start with a fantastic curriculum that was designed by whoever the best teacher in that subject is in the network. And it's crazy, frankly, that your average district doesn't do a better job of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of these charter networks do.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I probably am somewhere a little bit different on the spectrum with you guys. I mean, all I really care about at the end of the day is whether the kids learn, right? I don't particularly care what color the principal is, right? I don't particularly care if, you know, it's a mom and pop or a network. From the standpoint of the kid, I don't think it matters, right? And I know that, you know, that's probably an unpopular view in some corners, but I just think that has to be our our guiding star.
Kids first, baby. Kids first. All right.
That's
well, hey,
right.
Thank you for some good news. We need that, Amber. Keep the good news coming.
Yes, we do.
All right.
Absolutely.
Good. All right. Well, that is all the time we've got for this week. Until next week.
I'm David Griffith.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net. We'll be right back.